Hello and welcome to Science World. NASA has okayed the construction of a new Mars lander that will study the interior of the red planet and provide some insight into how planets like Earth were created. Scientists have developed a new experimental malaria vaccine that uses a protein to trap and kill the disease-causing parasites. And researchers have found yet another way the polar ice melt is affecting the Antarctic landscape. We'll talk with one of the authors of a study that found the ground that was pushed into the Earth's crust by the heavy ice is now springing back faster than expected. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology Magazine, Science World. NASA recently gave the green light for the construction of a new lander that will examine the deep interior of the red planet. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
The new Mars mission has the unwieldy name, the Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy, and Heat Transport, which is why everyone knows it by its acronym, InSight. The mission's spacecraft is scheduled to launch from California's Vandenberg Air Force Base in March of 2016 and arrive on Mars later that September. Bruce Bannert with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory is the InSight principal investigator. He told us that some of the technology the lander will use to study the interior of Mars is similar to what geologists have been using to study the Earth.
The idea behind it is to use some geophysical instruments, mostly a seismometer and a heat flow probe, to better understand the interior structure of Mars, both its composition, layering, what's going on inside, stuff like that.
InSight's study of the interior of Mars may not only provide fresh insight into the creation of our own planet, but also other Earth-like planets located within and beyond our solar system.
We really want to understand how the terrestrial planets, the rocky planets, formed early on in the solar system, and how that formation sort of led to the kinds of conditions we have on the surface.
Unlike the popular Curiosity and Opportunity rovers that are traveling across Mars, the InSight will be sent to a location near the red planet's equator and remain stationary to conduct its research. Bannert said that the new lander will map out the geography of the deep Martian interior.
And by that I mean, how thick is the crust? What's the crust made out of? And then how big is the core? And what is it made out of? What are the thermal characteristics of everything in terms of the heat flow, energy production, things like that?
The spacecraft will carry a bevy of sophisticated new instruments to carry out its mission. The space agencies of Germany, France, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom are providing two of the most important tools of the mission. Among InSight's instruments is a seismometer that will measure and analyze seismic waves that shake the ground, mostly due to quakes, or in this case, Mars quakes. Another tool aboard the Mars lander is a heat flow probe that will burrow itself down about 4.5 to 5 meters beneath the planet's surface. The device will measure small increases in temperature as it tunnels further into the crust of Mars. Bannert says this tool will allow his research team to figure out how much heat is coming from the planet's interior.
This heat flow is what drives a lot of the geology. It drives volcanism. On Mars, it can drive uplift of mountain ranges. And so the amount of heat coming out is a really basic parameter that we need to learn in order to find out how active a planet is.
One important tool that will be used to conduct InSight's research isn't really an instrument, but rather a radio on the spacecraft that will send out signals to be tracked by project scientists. Following the signal produced by the radio sitting on the rotating planet will allow the research team to watch Mars rotate on its axis and actually watch that axis wobble a little bit.
The size of that wobble tells us about the distribution of material inside the planet. So by using an analysis of this wobble, we can tell the details of the core, because that's what really drives the magnitude of these wobbles, is the size of the core, its density, and whether it's solid or liquid.
The new Mars lander will also be equipped with a weather station and camera that will provide further information about Mars. InSight's mission is expected to last about 1 Mars year, or 2 Earth years. By better understanding what's behind the interior of Mars, Bannert said that scientists will be able to get a better idea of what the Earth might have looked like very early in its history. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
Anthropologists in Argentina have uncovered bones of what they say may have been the biggest dinosaur that ever lived. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
The newfound dinosaur has been dubbed Titanosaur because of its titanic size. The scientists who made the discovery in Argentina said that the creature appeared to be about 40 meters long, 20 meters tall, and weighed 80,000 kilograms, or the equivalent of about 14 or 15 fully grown African elephants. But the scientists said that those figures reflected only their initial estimation. Upon further study, the creature could turn out to be even larger than that. The complete thigh bone they found is 2.4 meters long. The experts believe the huge dinosaur lived about 95 million years ago. But for its colossal size, scientists think that the titanosaur may have been a gentle giant, preferring to eat treetops instead of meat. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Scientists are developing a vaccine against malaria that is designed to limit the illness in children who have been bitten by mosquitoes carrying the disease-causing organism. Jessica Berman tells us more.
With the protein called SEA, the parasite is able to burst through infected red blood cells, ramping up disease symptoms. But malaria parasites deprived of SEA are trapped inside the cells, where they wither away and are eventually eliminated from the body by the spleen. Researchers at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and Boston Children's Hospital in Massachusetts discovered the protein. Jonathan Curtis is director of the Center for International Health Research at Rhode Island Hospital and lead author of the study, which appears in the journal Science. Curtis says an experimental vaccine containing antibodies against the parasitic protein was developed and tested in mice. Rodents that received the vaccine were only mildly sick and had fewer parasites in their bodies than untreated mice. Next, Curtis says investigators measured levels of antibodies to the SEA protein in a group of 785 Tanzanian children.
And children with antibodies to our protein never got severe malaria. There were zero cases, as compared to children who did not have antibodies to our protein.
Researchers then analyzed blood samples collected in 1997 from 140 children in Kenya. Investigators found there were 50% fewer parasites in the serum of youngsters that produced antibodies to SEA during a high transmission season. As with the Tanzanian children, there were also no severe cases of the disease in children with antibodies against the protein, according to Curtis.
And so the thought is, by immunizing people with the SEA protein so that they make their own antibodies, they'll be protected.
The next step, Curtis says, is to test a laboratory-made SEA vaccine to see whether it works in primates. Curtis says he's excited that researchers may be on the verge of an effective drug that lessens the severity of a malaria infection, but he's also humbled.
Our eye has to be on the prize, and the prize is, you know, a child every 15 seconds. Just during this phone conversation, you know, dozens and dozens of children have died of malaria. It's just unbelievable.
If the vaccine proves to be safe and effective in monkeys within the next year, researchers expect they'll move quickly to human vaccine trials. Curtis says the goal eventually is to immunize youngsters in malaria endemic regions at the same time they're vaccinated against other childhood illnesses. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
A few minutes ago, we told you about the new Mars lander that NASA will be building for a 2016 launch. For today's Science World Quick Quiz, we'd like to know from the following: what was the name of the very first spacecraft to not only successfully land on Mars, but also sent back the very first clear images of the surface of the red planet? Was it A, Mariner 1, B, Cosmos 419, or C, Viking 1? Good luck! We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
The 2014 Atlantic hurricane season outlook was released this past week by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Lausanne Skirbel's report looks at some of the tools the forecasters use to make their predictions.
Tom Boyd sits before a bank of computers that streams live data from weather satellites.
As we speak, we're looking at what is happening on the satellite. This schedule is actually happening on a satellite. It tells the imager and sounder when to start and stop and where to scan at over the U.S.
The imager works like a camera in space, and the sounder measures the temperature radiated from clouds, oceans, and air. Boyd is among the dozens of aerospace engineering technicians in the control room who gather that data and make sure the satellites run properly around the clock.
Earlier, we had a special event on this particular satellite. We just kind of brought it out of semi-storage and just started up the schedule. So we're expecting to see a few limits flag out until the thing settles down to satellite, probably over the next 24-hour period.
NOAA's fleet includes 16 satellites. Some remain in a set position over the United States. Others constantly circle the globe. The challenge is to get as accurate a picture of the atmosphere as possible, says Mike Condre, deputy director of NOAA's Office of Satellite Operations.
They give you the temperature, the winds, the humidity, the kind of information, and that is data is put into the computer models that the National Weather Service runs, and those computer models are what give people the long-term forecasts, 3 days, 5 days, 7 day forecasts to prepare.
And those long-term forecasts can save lives.
Every time we see a hurricane, every time we see any kind of severe weather out there, that underscores the importance to the folks out here on the floor of what they do every day.
Condre expects predictions to get even better with the launch of the Joint Polar Satellite System in early 2017.
What these will provide is about an order of magnitude, in other words, about 10 times more volume of data on the atmospheric state of the winds, the temperature, and the humidity in the atmosphere.
That information will improve the day-to-day forecast. Seasonal forecasts rely on even more data sources. In addition to satellites, they depend on ocean buoys that record sea temperatures and observations from ships. NOAA and Colorado State University issue annual hurricane reports to let planners and the public know what to expect. Warmer than normal waters in the tropical Pacific generally indicate fewer storms in the Atlantic. CSU research scientist Philip Klotzbach mines the tropical Atlantic for similar clues. He spoke via Skype.
If the waters are warmer than normal, that tends to mean there's more fuel for the developing storms. If the atmospheric pressures are lower than normal, that tends to mean that the atmosphere is more unstable and more conducive for storms to form and to intensify.
But errors do occur. An active Atlantic hurricane season was predicted last year. That didn't happen.
It is certainly very difficult to predict and is very complicated because the atmosphere and the ocean interact in a very complicated manner, and you have to take into account a lot of these complicated relationships when you're issuing these seasonal predictions.
But Klotzbach says mistakes better inform the next forecast, adding prediction remains an inexact science. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
American pop artist Andy Warhol is best known for his paintings of a Campbell's soup can and actress Marilyn Monroe. But almost no one remembers that in the mid-1980s, he also did some experimentation with a computer called the Amiga. Kane Faribault tells us how the world of art and science got together to save Warhol's computer art.
Stepping into Pittsburgh software engineer Keith Baer's basement is like stepping into a computing time machine. His bulky screen and noisy disk drives have spent the last several decades on most other people's shelves, collecting dust.
They had a level of simplicity oftentimes that we don't see in modern computers anymore.
His fellow members of the Carnegie Mellon University Computer Club called Baer the Amiga Guru, as in Commodore Computing Company's Amiga Computer. Never heard of it? Let's flash back to 1985, when the Commodore Amiga was the newest and greatest computer. To create buzz at the Amiga launch party, Commodore enlisted artist Andy Warhol to demonstrate its capabilities, which incorporated a drawing tablet and another revolutionary device, a digital camera.
He took some digital pictures and then modified them, you know, before most people had been thinking about digital photography at all.
And that's about all the public got to see of Warhol's digital artwork. After his death in 1987, the computer and floppy disks were stored in the archives at the Warhol Museum. And the story about Andy Warhol's experiment with the Amiga almost ended there.
Those drawings would have been lost.
Divya Heffley, with the Carnegie Museum of Art's Hillman Photography Initiative, is producing the documentary series The Invisible Photograph. Stumbling across the YouTube video of the 1985 Amiga launch sparked an idea that brought the Carnegie Museum of Art together with the Warhol Museum and Baer's CMU Computer Club in an attempt to recover the contents of Warhol's Amiga computer. As cameras rolled, they logged into the unknown.
Nobody knew what we were going to find on those disks.
Baer says it took some time for the team to understand the software used to create the images.
Not only is it relying on the digital media that's able to understand that digital data.
After some reverse software engineering, they hit pay dirt.
That is a Warhol that nobody has ever seen before.
The iconic images of a digital Campbell's soup can and Warhol's self-portrait are just a few of some 20 images recovered from floppy disks. Heffley says the search for Warhol's art is both a history lesson and a cautionary tale.
If we're not careful, technology will become obsolete, and we will no longer have the ability to see the photographs, to see the images that we hold so dear and so precious.
The Warhol images, now restored and archived, can be viewed by watching the Carnegie Museum of Art's latest installment of the Invisible Photograph online documentary series entitled Trapped. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Let's see if you've correctly answered this week's Science World Quick Quiz. A few minutes ago, we asked, what was the name of the very first spacecraft to not only successfully land on Mars, but also sent back the very first clear images of the surface of the red planet? Was it A, Mariner 1, B, Cosmos 419, or C, Viking 1? The answer is C. The Viking 1 was sent to Mars by NASA as part of the Viking program. Viking 1 was launched in August of 1975, and it successfully landed on Mars 11 months later in July of 1976. Moments after it landed, it became the first spacecraft to send back clear and up-close images of the surface of Mars. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week. You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science. On last week's program, we had a report about the effect melting ice sheets in Antarctica is having on the polar region's weather. Today, on our one-on-one segment, we'll hear about another way the ice melt is impacting Antarctica. In years past, as the ice sheets grew, the ground beneath them was pushed downward due to the heavy weight of the expanding ice sheet. But a new study led by Newcastle University in the UK has revealed that since the Antarctic ice sheets have been melting, they're not as heavy and aren't putting as much pressure on the earth beneath, so the ground below is springing back up. The problem is that this process is taking place much faster than anyone expected. One of the authors of this study is Peter Clark. He's a professor at Newcastle University and joins us today to talk about these studies and what their research revealed. Professor, what have you and your colleagues discovered hundreds of miles beneath the surface in Antarctica?
What we've discovered is that the solid rocks, or rocks that we think are solid, this deep underneath the Earth, are actually flowing about 1,000 times faster than we thought was possible for the rest of Antarctica.
So is this happening to all of Antarctica or just portions?
No, our study's been limited to the northern part of the Antarctic Peninsula, where about a decade ago, two major ice sheets collapsed and allowing the glaciers just inland of those to surge. So that's changed the weight bearing down on the surface of the Earth. And we're looking at the response to that particular region.
So what is something called elastic response?
You can think of the Earth a little bit like the skin of a drum or something. If you put a marble down on the drum, then the skin of the drum would be depressed by the weight of the marble. And when you take it off, then the skin of the drum comes flat again. That would be an elastic or an instantaneous response. What we're seeing here is a combination of an elastic response like that and a viscous response, which is if you could imagine that the drum was perhaps full of treacle. So not only would it respond instantly, but then over time, the treacle would flow and allow the drum's surface to change even further.
So how much is the land currently rising each year?
Well, we're seeing rates of up to 15 millimeters per year. That's over half an inch. And in fact, our model predicts that nearby, the rates could even get as high as 45 millimeters per year. That's nearly 2 inches.
What's the normal rate of change that takes place?
What we see in the rest of Antarctica is probably no more than 4 or 5 millimeters per year at the most. And in fact, previously, in some quite nearby parts of the Antarctic Peninsula, we've only seen rates down at less than a millimeter per year in some places.
How is this affecting the appearance of Antarctica?
In the short term, not very much. This has only been going on for 10 years, and probably all of the deformation will have finished in another few decades. So the changes are only going to be of the order of a few centimeters overall. But we see the similar kind of thing happening in the long term in the landscapes of North America, of Northern Europe, and indeed around the rest of Antarctica. But what we're seeing here is this landscape change happening only to a small extent, but very much faster than we'd expected.
Let's go back to the effect of ice melt in this process. What does ice melt have to do with this movement?
Well, the ice melting, discharging, is what's actually caused the movement in the first place. So back in 2002, quite a large ice sheet just off the coast of the Antarctic Peninsula broke up and collapsed. And what that ice sheet was doing was that it was acting a bit like a dam, buttressing the glaciers and the Antarctic Peninsula and stopping them from flowing out into the sea as fast as they might have been. Now that buttress isn't there anymore. The glaciers are flowing out much faster. So the weight of ice bearing down on the Earth's surface in this part is much less than it used to be.
And what do you mean that the mantle below the Earth's crust and the Antarctic Peninsula is flowing much faster than expected and that it's runnier? What kind of temperature or chemical changes could be bringing this about?
Well, it could be a combination of two things, actually. Yes, it could be a slight fluctuation in temperature in the mantle here, or it could be a slight fluctuation in the chemical composition of the mantle compared with places nearby. Tectonically, we do think that this part of Antarctica might be a little bit different to the rest. But to know exactly what is causing these differences in viscosity, we're going to have to go back and take some more measurements, not just with GPS, but also with seismometers.
Professor, I'm curious, how did you and your colleagues go about making your findings, and what kind of tests and experiments did your team conduct?
Well, we brought together quite a wide variety of different data sets that my different collaborators each brought to the table, as it were. So we started out with some data from GPS receivers. These are scientific GPS receivers, much more precise than the sat-nav in people's cars, that can measure movements of the surface of the solid Earth to within millimeters or less than millimeters per year. And we had a puzzle there, that the GPS data from this region were showing that the Earth was uplifting at this much faster rate than we previously thought was going to be likely. So to add to that, then, we brought in some data from a satellite known as ICESat, which has a laser pointing downwards from the satellite that measures the height of the ice sheets in the region. And that showed that these ice sheets, since the collapse of the Larsen ice shelf about a decade ago, were now losing their ice at a rate of tens of meters per year in a few places. So we put that evidence together with the evidence we had from GPS and a mathematical model that told us how the Earth should respond to this change in the weight of the ice. And that's how we got our results.
And finally, Professor Clark, why do you consider your findings significant?
The significant thing is that this part of the Antarctic Peninsula is behaving so differently to what we think is true for the rest of Antarctica and indeed the rest of the world. And this is going to have an implication for the way in which we can use measurements of the ice height and of the gravity field of the Earth in order to monitor the changes in the ice sheet in the future.
That was Peter Clark, Professor of Geophysical Geodesy at Newcastle University in the United Kingdom. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.